show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 633. I'm one of your hosts, Skyler, and joining me today is none other than Jim McDowell. Jim, how's it going, man?
Hey, we're still in quarantine, still locked down, still working hard from home. Take for that what you want. But actually, I do, because I think I spend more time now working than I did before, because I can't figure out how to delineate between what is work time and what's home time.
Yeah, I kind of...
For whatever it's worth.
The thing that's like, I love my office. I have it all set up, like, when I do my gaming and we do recording, and now that I'm here all day long during work, I kind of don't want to be in here anymore. I'm just like, oh.
Same feeling.
So, but it's good. So on this show, we're going to be going over listener feedback. We've had a lot of listener feedback. We've enjoyed reading it. So we're going to touch bases on a few emails and then kind of give a little bit of a layout of how we're going to answer some of those emails going on in the future. We'll be answering some questions and just general banter between me and Jim. If you want to go ahead and donate to the show, you can by going to our website. That's motopodcast.com. On the left-hand side, you'll see two little PayPal buttons. One, you can make a one-time donation. The other time, you can have a subscription. Doesn't matter how much or how little, whatever you'd like to give to the show, we do appreciate it. It helps keep the light on here. If PayPal is not your thing, remember that we always have a Patreon page as well. And so that can be found, that's at patreon.com/motopod. You can go and donate there. So we're going to do things a little bit different on the show. Because we have so much listener feedback, we're going to flip that around. We're going to actually go into the news first. And before we get started with the news, you know what's coming. You know what time it is. Oh, it's beer 30, everybody. All right. So today, so I got something new when I was down at the store because I like the can. It's from Revision Brewing Company, and it's called Snarf Snarf. The name, I couldn't tell you why, but the can is cool. It's got a great white shark on it, and the fish are all little hop fish, which is kind of cool. So this is a New England-style hazy, but it's a double IPA. And so let's go ahead and give this one a taste, and I'll let you know. All right, so being that it's a double IPA, it kind of washes out the haziness of it. It's still a pretty strong beer, but I would say definitely hop forward. Not too shabby at all. I do like it. As far as hazy, I wouldn't really call it so much that. But there you go, Jim.
Well, you know, you are a beer aficionado. I myself am not a beer aficionado. I am more a man of the harder liquors.
Oh, yes.
I like my bourbon.
No, I am good. I wouldn't say it's a phase because it turned into a nice collection, but I've got quite a bit of scotch these days.
Nice.
I can't do the scotch in the show because I'll probably make it to about the 30-minute mark and be as bad as I was at the end of last week's show.
I thought you were great at the end of last week's show. You were fantastic.
Oh, yeah, no, it was fun.
You were on point.
You ever go back and listen to yourself and you're like, oh,
yes.
Okay.
I listened to every one of them.
And so I was hearing myself, and I could hear the words getting a little slurring to them. And there was definitely a little bit of happiness. But, you know, I was having a good time. I think that's all that matters. And people seem to enjoy it. We got a lot of good feedback on it.
Yeah. It was one of the shows that had some more of the... Yeah. Let's try this again. And I haven't been drinking. So I don't have an excuse. Yeah. It did generate a lot of listener feedback, and I think it was probably one of the shows that generated the most feedback. There's a lot of emails, a lot of things that had happened from that last show. So appreciate everybody writing in and sharing and letting us know what they thought about it.
And since you bring that up, remember, if you want to write into the show, we can be found at motopod@motopodcast.com. That goes to all the hosts. Sometimes we answer directly in the email, sometimes we put them away and save them for a future show like today. And we'll get to those emails in just a moment, but let's hop into the news. So the first thing that's coming up is something that I think me and Jim might have discussed, or we compared it to when we were saying F1, but MotoGP is preparing for closed-door races. They sent notifications off to teams this week saying, hey, how many people do you need for a race weekend? What is the minimum that you can have? So basically, we'd be racing for TV, right? You wouldn't have fans there. You may have some closed sponsorships or people that are there. Excuse me. And you will also have, of course, the team, all the tire suppliers, people that make everything work at MotoGP. And that's it. Fans, I'm sorry. They're thinking, we're not going to be able to do this with the fans gathering. But we definitely need to get the season started. So they're reaching out to local governments to seeing what restrictions they may have on being able to put on a show while everything is kind of, while we're trying now to turn this corner. We're going to test these waters. Hopefully everything goes right, but we're going to have to find out here approaching the warmer weather that we're coming up to.
Yeah, that's one of the things that we have to be very careful about. My wife is in the healthcare industry, and we cannot simply just say, oh, okay, everything's great, and open the doors up and let everybody flood out and intermingle and go everywhere together. Because if we do, we run a very, very high risk that we can spike the virus back again and get it started going again, and we'll be right back to where we are right now, locked down, sheltered in place, those kind of things. So we need to just sort of slowly turn everything back on and slowly open up everything, and we need to monitor these things, and we got to see how these things are going and how things are going to go as we start to interact again. And hopefully we get out of this and everything comes back. And if we have to have the first few races without fans, it's going to suck. I know people who have tickets, not sure what the tracks are going to do. I would assume everybody's going to get a refund. That's an assumption on my part. But I really hope that we don't wind up losing tracks and promoters over this, because the money flow isn't coming in. But if I have a choice, if it's me and it's COTA, and you know, I've got airline tickets and hotel, rental car tickets, all that stuff. If they're going to run a motorcycle race and they say, hey, we're going to run COTA, but we're going to do it behind closed doors because of the virus, I'm willing to throw those tickets in the garbage can just to have some racing. That's how I see it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, all of us that listen to the show, we're all a bunch of maniacs listening to two guys talk about motorcycle racing that we're not even getting to watch right now. So we're definitely all frothing at the mouth to get back to action. And I think a lot of us feel the same way you do, Jim, where it's like we're willing to make the sacrifice and have an understanding that this year is going to be different. But let us get back to racing ASAP.
I agree.
All right, so Vinales came out this week and he started saying that he definitely did have an offer from Ducati when he was getting his last contract together before he signed.
Okay, wait a second. Hold on. Time out. We should ask this question of everybody in the paddock. Who has not been asked by Ducati to ride their motorcycle?
This is true.
It would be simpler.
Yeah, you know, you do have a good point. And that's kind of a good thing for Ducati, right? Always, you know, keeping the door open, because obviously at this level of racing, the riders are all very good. And you would hate to miss an opportunity by not reaching out to somebody with the simple, hey, do you want to ride for us? What's the worst they could say? No. Okay, cool. Thanks. Like, why not? But he did say that it was a pretty close decision to go over to Ducati. He does feel that maybe his riding style would be able to mesh with the bike. Unsure, which, you know, I think most people will say they're unsure until they actually get on it. But overall, he decided to choose the Yamaha because it gave him the best opportunity to go after a championship, which I think he's probably right, because he knows the Yamaha. He knows it well. He knows the team. He knows what they're working on. He doesn't know the Ducati. He sees that it's good on the track, but he also seen people go to Ducati and not perform so well. And so he probably thought about it good and hard and probably had a nice check sitting over there waiting for him if he did want to jump ship. But in the end, decided to go with Yamaha. And to be honest, it's probably the best decision, because we've seen many times in the past that going from a Yamaha to Ducati isn't always the easiest thing.
No, definitely not. I wonder if Ducati is becoming sort of like Ferrari in F1, where there's an allure of going there. And I think what draws most riders to it is this, there's an ego element here. Well, I want to be the guy who wins another world title for Ducati, right? I mean, it's been a long patch, right? Like, Stoner was the last guy to win on world championship on that bike. So, and what was that, 2007, right?
Yep, 2007, yeah.
So, yeah. The perfect storm, as our founder Bob Hayes always has said. And, you know, there's something about the ego part where if you're the guy who's actually able to do this, you are now a legend. You will never be forgotten. sort of like Schumacher when he went to Ferrari in their darkest times. They hadn't won a world title in 20 years and he did it, right? The man's a legend now. Everyone will know that Schumacher won a world title in a Ferrari. So if you're the next person to win a world title on a Ducati, your name is, it's engraved in the history book, guaranteed. And I think that's a bit of the allure.
Yeah, I'd agree with you on that, right? Obviously, writing for an Italian factory outlet, especially because of the fan base and the following that Ducati has. I mean, Ducati has a crazy following, not just in racing, but just in general in itself. It has, you know, the whole Ducati week where they bring people in. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to have one of their sport bikes. I mean, it's catered to everybody. So yes. Ducati is very, not in a bad way to say like a cult, but once you're in, it's kind of hard to get away from being a Ducati. What is the term they have? Ducatista or something? What is it?
Yes. Yeah. That's pretty much the best way to pronounce that because I can't do it. Okay. And I'll let you go with that.
All right,
and
cool.
I'm very happy.
So I'm sure that Jules will be able to correct us on that because I know he's got actually have a Ducati sitting in my garage. I don't even know what I'm talking about. I'm sitting here to this. It's not mine, but there is one that's in there. So, all right. Now, MotoGP has officially confirmed that the regulations for the engine and aerodynamic developments will be frozen for this season and next season. Because of everything that's going on, everybody had to roll back on, obviously, the testing, the resources, the being able to develop parts for this year. And instead of crushing all this development into everybody where the big teams would be able to do it, the small teams would not. And that I'm not talking about privateer to factory. I'm talking like HRC compared to Suzuki. It's that big of a jump. To make it a fairer playing field, they're going to go ahead and wait until after 2021. Before they start making any changes to the current bike. So if the racing is really good this year, we're going to get to see repeat next year. So that's exciting.
Yeah, I also think that this was a necessary evil because of the economic situation brought on by the pandemic.
Indeed.
So, I mean, if, you know, I don't want to say it's 2008 again and what happened with, let's say, Formula One teams and all of that good stuff. But there's a limited amount of money that these corporations are willing to spend, and it's bang for the buck for what it's going to take to run an operation. And if they get into this development and they're sending a bunch of people and giving them their pink slips and whatnot and, you know, laying them off, or I forget what the British term is for it, making them redundant, I think is the correct term. There's going to be some backlash faced by these corporations and companies. So if you freeze it and say, hey, you can't develop anything, this is what you got is what you got, and we stay right here, you've got probably the fairest playing field that you could have, especially coming out of this, right? And yeah, I think it's, you know, a smart move. I mean, it's good for everyone involved, to be honest.
Yeah, no, I think it's a very wise move, and it protects the teams, being that they've seen what happens when the economy has a tough time. Teams have to leave. And then we had to resort to things like the CRT bikes and all of that. They don't want to go back to those days.
I don't want that come back again ever.
Everybody is going to be able to make it through this and jump back full-fledged racing come next year. So, all right, well, that's all I really had in the news. Is there anything else you wanted to cover there, Jim?
No, I think that is apropos. I mean, there's not much changing. And I think we're only going to get more news when we decide to start getting the economies going again and start to let people travel again, then the news is going to pick up. I mean, we're just sort of in that, like, wintertime lull where there's not really a lot of news. So
yeah, it's a lot of gossip.
I'm good with it.
I don't think we need to cover all of that because it's a lot of hearsay and people being bored and coming up with the most wacky stories. So it's like, all right, we'll wait till more official things come to fruition if that is the case.
Yep. Let's get into the fan mail.
All right. So the first one I have here is from Grant Hefferman. He wrote in his top 10 writers of all time. He did it in Italian. What do you think, Jim? Should I give this a try in Italian, or should I just skip over it?
I think you should.
All right.
Just do it in Italian.
Let's butcher this language. Okay. I did try to learn it for like 2 months before I went to Italy last year, on and off. So, yeah, there might be some level of competency, but we'll compensate you there. Oh, we're already off to a bad start. Anyway, all right, here we go.
How much alcohol is in that double IPA?
You swear a lot. I don't know. We'll have to go ahead and slow the roll on that. All right, so here we go. Decimo, Valentino Rossi. Nono, Valentino Rossi. Ottimo, Valentino Rossi. Settimo, Valentino Rossi. Sesto, Valentino Rossi. Quinto, Valentino Rossi. Quattro, Valentino Rossi. Terzo, Valentino Rossi. Secondo, Valentino Rossi. And primo, Valentino Rossi. So if you didn't catch that, he put 1 through 10, Valentino Rossi. I think perhaps, Jim, Grant might be a Valentino Rossi fan. I'm just... possibly.
Possibly, or... that was a little tongue-in-cheek. Take your pick.
Thanks, Grant, for writing.
I didn't like it. It made me laugh. Yeah. I thought it was clever, and I thought it was pretty well done. So, yes, congratulations to you, Grant. You made me chuckle.
I did, too. Thanks for writing in, Grant. We do appreciate it. I had a good laugh at that as well. All right, so our next email that we have here is from a longtime listener and donor to the show, Joshua Tutel. So he wrote in, I believe in the last episode you guys mentioned side hobbies. Well, I transitioned from racing motor pickles very poorly several years ago to cycling, ultra running, and triathlon. All right, this man is a fit guy. I listened to the most recent episode near the beginning of my Tuesday night ride, and connecting the last two episodes talking about riding the corkscrew backwards, I have done that. I did it at full race pace. I was going about 3 miles per hour on a mountain bike, but that was my best effort. Racing the pro... cross-country race at Sea Otter last year. I earned my pro license in cross-country mountain bike a few years ago. Barely. I wouldn't want to do that with the large sum of mechanized horsepower. Thanks for writing in, Joshua. Actually, you know, it's funny. It kind of brings up a good topic here of cycling altogether with motorcycles. It does seem to be hand-in-hand almost these days. A lot of guys obviously use bicycles for training, and therefore a lot of them end up turning into that, especially when they're done with motorcycle racing. Go see Ben Spees. For example, a lot of the guys here that I'm with when I was working with the AFM, they did cycling, and I got really into cycling for a long time. I'm talking like down to like 6% fat cycling. Ooh. Lost all my weight. I was probably about 30 pounds lighter than I am now. But that's cool. Joshua, thanks for riding in, and hopefully I'll get to see you soon because I've actually got a cross-country bike now I started training. So we'll go ahead and shoot some emails and trade some stories. All right, who's next? All right, Alan F. I'm going to say that's Alan Fleming. Wouldn't you agree there, Jim?
It is. Perfect. It is Alan Fleming.
Of course. Alan's a longtime listener, writer, and all of that good stuff to the show. He enjoyed hearing our top 10 list, and he gave us a few ideas for future top 10 lists. And we're going to go ahead and pause it there, Alan, because we do like your list, and we're going to go ahead and bring this up on our future show, a little bit more top 10. So we'll go ahead and jump into that. And that brings us to our main email of the week. And that's going to be Steve Reiling, like we said on the last show. And he gave us a bunch of good topics. And we're going to take this email. We're going to kind of do it chunk by chunk. I'm going to give my reactions to certain parts. Jim's going to give his. I'm going to go from there. So he starts off, hey guys, here's some miscellaneous stuff. Reacting to the last episode, gaming may be more popular, but I never liked it. Even when I had friends that did, I actually love motorcycle racing specifically because it's real and physical. And I see the riders pushing to their limits in a more visible and true way. I work with tons of digital equipment. The last thing I want is fake racing. I'll let you go ahead and get a little start on that part there, Jim.
Yeah, I agree with you, Steve. I'm not a fan of the virtual racing that we're doing. Mainly because I get sick if I watch it, which is, I know it sounds really stupid, but my son likes to game and he's got all the games and I'm telling you, he's like, oh, Dad, watch this. Okay. And I'll stand there and I'll watch and I swear I'm going to vomit. It just makes me, I think I get motion sickness is what happens. But the bizarre part is if I'm playing the game, I can tolerate it, but I can't tolerate it for long. I'm good for maybe an hour. Now, you know, back in my 20s, I could do Xbox all night long, but not anymore. So I see where he's coming from with that. And the other thing for me is that I think I did this, I've raced bikes. So to me, I understand the feeling of what's going on. There's no feeling when you're racing a video game. Like I have no connection in that video game between myself and the front end of my motorcycle. Zero. I can't tell if it's sliding. I can't tell if the front end's about to tuck. I can't feel any of that, but I can feel all of that if I'm actually on the motorcycle. and everything is about feel. And there's also a sort of a visceral noise thing that happens when you're on the motorcycle for me. And that's, I've got all of this wind that's running around me, and my head's buffeting in the wind. And when you pop up out of the bubble, it feels like it's going to just literally rip you off the motorcycle. And then you slam on the brakes and you're thrown forward on the motorcycle. And it's like trying to do like 100 push-ups in 10 seconds as you try to decelerate for the corner. And then, you know, the noise kind of dies down and you go into the corner. Next thing you hear is you hear your knee slider kind of tapping on the ground, and you hear that grind. And none of that's in the game. It just isn't there. And I even think that a lot of times the crashes are fairly fake looking. Like, oh, this little tap bump. Ooh, and he got flicked off the high side and he slams onto the ground. And 2 seconds later, well, you're just right back on the bike and you're riding again. We all know that that's not what happens in reality. And it's not reality based. And I think, you know, again, it's all back to that feel. If you're riding a dirt bike and you jump a dirt bike, for that moment in time, you feel that weightlessness as you're waiting to come back down on the other side of that jump. And you just don't have any of that inside the game. They're fun. I'm not going to cut it down in that way, shape, or form. I think if you want to learn tracks and know whether they went left or right or uphill or downhill, I think that helps you a lot too. But I just want to go do it myself. I don't want to pretend doing it.
No, I definitely understand where you're coming from on that. Sim racing has its appeal as far as, obviously, we get to watch some level of competition, which is kind of fun. I'm pretty sure a lot of us are just competitive people that watch and enjoy that kind of thing. But it's, like you said, it's nothing compared to the actual thing, because when motorcycle racing, the same argument's been kind of had for going to electric bikes, is that you're getting rid of the smell, the feel, the sound, the buzz, all of that. It's not there, but I don't think we really can expect that. It's just something in the meantime that we can kind of pass our time with. But he also did, you know, go into a second part on this. He says that, and this is, you know, of course, Steve again, he goes, but I'll give MotoGP points for trying to make the site interesting, or making the racing after, and getting some of the video of the riders at least makes them more human. Since you can see their personalities a little bit more. Obviously, you know, they're not in their helmets, and we can kind of see them in a more relaxed environment. In fact, that's what I think they should do, more of just Skype video calls and ask them questions about their training, what they like about bikes, what they're hoping for, their life away from bikes. The more I know about the riders, the more into racing I'll be when the season actually arrives. They can set this up to being the best season ever for a lot of people because they'll care more about the guys on track. Now, here, Steve, this is actually a really good point of what they could be doing, and they could blend this in. And they do a little bit of it during, because I did finally watch one of the digital races or simulation races or whatever you want to call them. But they actually do get to a little bit. And you do get to see the riders in more of a relaxed environment. You get to see them the camera's on, so they definitely are selling themselves a bit. But it's not as intense as during a normal MotoGP weekend. But you're right. It would be cool to kind of get some behind the scenes, like, hey, let's go follow this guy around. And like, hey, what are you doing right now? What's going on? I know a lot of celebrities are doing the, like, send me questions, I'll go on Instagram and answer them, that kind of thing. That would be a very cool thing for MotoGP to do.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's great that they gave us, like, older racing to watch, and there's simulated racing to watch, and I think that that's something. But I think they're missing this opportunity to take these guys and show us that they're actually real human beings. Now, whether you do I'm a hockey fan, and so last Friday they had House of Hockey. So it was an interview with the captain of the team that I love the most. They sat down, he took questions from everybody in the media, and you not the media, but everybody who was attending this live event.
What team would that be, by the way?
Now, that would be the Columbus Blue Jackets.
Okay, there we go. Just wanted to find out.
Yeah, that's cool. No, that's cool. And there was all these kids were asking questions, and it was things like, well, what's your favorite color? What do you do with your daughter? How do you keep her in? It was these real personal questions. It wasn't, you know, well, you were out there tonight on the ice, and did you feel like you had the game won, or, you know, that kind of stuff. That's like the repetitive questions. It was, hey, this is a person who's dealing with the same problems that I'm dealing with. I'm stuck with my kid trying to teach him school, trying to do my actual work, trying to help my son with his schoolwork, and all those things that are there. And you you bond it with that person because you realize that that person you see, who happens to be this hockey player or it's a motorcycle racer or whatever, they're dealing with the same problems and the same emotions and the same things that you're dealing with during this. So it puts everybody on this even playing field and lets you actually have an insight into there. I mean, we know Rossi is his own personal character and he's got his own flair. And at times Rossi was bigger than all of MotoGP, right? I think we talked about that, Skyler. But we don't know who the next big one's going to be. Quartararo could be that. He might be that funny. He might be that clever, but we don't really know because we're not allowed to see anything than this polished corporate image person. You know, here in America, you had NASCAR, huge spectator sport, and a lot of its appeal was back in the when it first got on TV in 79, I think the 79 Daytona 500, Cale Yarborough wound up punching one of the other guys that was driving because they got into a wreck on the last lap. They had a fist fight. And there's been that sort of redneck, backwoods, fight 'em up kind of thing that's kind of gone on. But as money has come into the sport, you had to become more polished. And now it's like every NASCAR driver, as soon as they hop out of the car, well, I got to thank my sponsors, my National Guard, 88 Mountain Dew, Pepsi Cola, Quaker State Motor Oil. You know, they run down the list of sponsors. And it's just robotic. It's this polished corporate robot, which I understand that's a part of the sport, that and that's where the money comes from. But there's got to be a person inside of there. And that's what we want to see. We want to relate to that person as opposed to relating to this robot. And if we could get inside a little bit, we're going to love those guys more because there's going to be some little thing that you find out that maybe, who knows what it is. Maybe you find out that Marquez loves the mountain bike. Well, I mountain bike too, right? Or whatever this is, there's some other little common ground that you're going to do. I'm like, I remember this. It was kind of weird. I've gone to Indy when they had the MotoGP races there throughout time. And I had pit passes, and not where you could get into the hot pit lane, but you're walking around in the closed off area. And it was back when Colin Edwards was still racing. At the time, Colin was running on the NTR bikes, and he was going to go do Baja at the end of the year. And I walked by, Colin walks by me. I said, "Hey, Colin, good luck in Baja. Be safe." Colin stops. He turns around. He says, "Hey, thanks. I appreciate that." Because that's something that bind, you know, my love of, I would love to go do Baja. And he wanted to go do something. But it was like that, there was a different connection there. It wasn't me asking the same question that he hears from everybody about, "Oh, how's your bike today? You know, what do you think the track's like?" Those things. It was a different question. And so there's a different level that we were on at that time. And I think we need to do that or try to do it because we're going to love the product more. If we do,
those are all definitely good points, and I agree. The more human you make these riders, the more of a connection you have to them, and it can only, you know, increase your fandom, especially of the riders that are going to be bringing us into this new age. When Rossi retires, it's going to be pretty much everybody's new at that point. So we definitely need to know who these people are and what they're about. And I agree with all the points that you have made. Alrighty, so he brought us into because of. MotoGP is now offering a free subscription until the season gets started. Steve says, "I've actually watched a few old races, and that sort of works. But it is weird hearing the commentators get all worked about riders that have been out of the sport for a while. But what the hell? It's racing." And that's true. It is kind of strange when you do hear a rider, you know, the commentators, especially if you're going back and you're hearing commentators aren't even with the sport anymore. Just a few years, though. But you are hearing this and you're hearing, you know, like, "All right, here comes Sete Gibernau around the corner." It's like, "Oh, wait, yeah, Sete's been gone for a while." And actually, it's funny that Sete's been gone for a while, but Rossi's still here. So that just gives you how big of a time gap there is from those two careers. But I will say that while it is strange, it is kind of cool to go back and watch the racing to have a better understanding of how we got to where we are now.
Right, yep. The one thing that I wish that they would do is they just sort of show you the race, the old races. It's just, here's the feed of what happened at that moment in time. And years ago when, well, it was Speed Vision and it became Speed, I think, or whatever, they had the rights to Formula One. And they did Well, I think they did like Decade of Speed. So they went back to the Formula One races that were like a decade old, and they showed those races again. But they did it in a highlight form. They showed you sort of the important things. But what made it interesting was Steve Matchett would come on, and he was actually in the pit lane. He was a mechanic for Benetton, and I know definitely for Benetton. I think Tolman too, at the very beginning of his career. But the thing was, he added insight to what was going on from, say, the pit lane or at that time. They did a better job of setting the scene of what you were about to see. And they added details that you didn't know from the first time that you watched it, because you have the idea of hindsight being 20/20. And they would talk about those things. And that made those entertaining, because you learned something that you didn't know, and you kind of would go, oh, well, that's why the car was that way, or that's why this guy drove for this team, or whatever it is. You learned about it in a way that you didn't know it before. So I wish they would kind of have done that. It would make it better. I'm not going to complain. It is racing. It's just one of those things, you just could have touched it up a little bit, and it would have just been just that much better.
To Speed Vision, you're tugging at my heartstrings there. Oh, man, what a great channel that was until NASCAR bought them out. Fox bought them out. That was, oh man. I remember tuning in to Speed Vision at like 11 o'clock on a Saturday and watching DTM racing out of nowhere. You could just 24 hours a day racing. Oh, it was a beautiful thing that just no longer exists. Oh, well.
Yeah.
All right. Back on track. Now, here's where me and Jim get to talk more than usual, which is kind of nice. Well, maybe nice for us. I don't know, for you guys, we talk a lot and ramble on. But so he goes, I'm interested in hearing about your racing experience, crashes, successes, both, and what you imagine might be different with MotoGP guys. Now, everybody knows Jim has raced. I have not, but I was a wrench for racing. So I'll tell probably my favorite story of conquering a bad situation, I guess. So when I was a wrench, I worked with my team here. It's an AFM team. It was called Z2 Racing. And I worked with the kid. His name was Cameron Gish. And so when I was working with Cameron at the time, he's about 16 years old. And his first year I started working with him, he was kind of coming away from the two-stroke dirt bikes and all of that, and kind of really focusing in on doing circuit racing. And so he got an R6. Within the first three races, he was caught up to speed with everybody else. By the end of the season, he was winning races. So the next season, he just really, really got after it, was dominant in AFM, was setting track records. And so we prepared him for the AMA race. I guess at that time it was called DMG. We hadn't quite moved on to Moto America just yet. This is back, I believe, this is going to be the 2012 season. I'd have to check, but it doesn't really matter for the context of this story. So we finally get to our first AMA weekend. It's a big thing for all of the whole team. We're right there. We go through qualifying. He qualifies fourth for the race. And actually, I think he might have got third. Now I'm trying to remember. I'm messing up my own story. Anyway, we got into such a high position that everybody in the paddock was like, who is this kid? Why is he placing in the top three or four? And all season long, we've been racing, and he's beating guys out that have been here all year. Like, we're all pros, and he's just walking up here. And of course, you know, a lot of people did know him because he's very good friends with, like, Cambobier and several others, and he's been making his way up. He was, like, Red Bull rookies. But regardless, he still made a huge splash. So the next day, the race day comes, and we're super excited. We're like, all right, cool. You know, he could definitely fight the guys for the win. He's at his home track. We've set records here. It's going to be a good day. He gets a good start. He's running with the big dog. He's up there. Lap three comes on the corner, right out in the straightaway, makes a left, loses the front end, crashes, but the rider behind him runs right over him. He's not moving. Red flag. And the panic starts to set in because they roll the ambulance. There's no updates. The entire place goes quiet. We don't know what's going on. I run back, grab the second bike, because in my head, it's like he's going to pop up. We're going to be good. He can get back on the backup bike, because I think we're still within that window, even though we weren't. It was only within the first two laps if it got red flagged, you could get the backup bike. So we were definitely past that. We go down to the end of the pit straight, look over, he's still not doing well. He's laying there. The second ambulance pulls up. More and more people are showing up. We can hear the helicopter start to spin up. We're like, this is not good. We get him loaded in the ambulance. We can't get any updates. We send his mom to go find out what's going on. She goes with him. And he's off an ambulance. And we're back to the pits. Just completely terrified what's happened to this kid. So we finally get to the hospital and find out the extent of the injuries. It's pretty severe. Broken pelvis. Torn MCL. He had like several internal injuries. Chipped bones. Chipped vertebrae. And a number of bruises and contusions and everything else. You name it, this kid basically, you know, he got ran over. He's in a bad way. Season done, right? So we all said, well, sometimes that's the way it goes. But this kid is resilient. And he's young, so it helps. 122 days later, we get to the end of the season of AFM. He shows up, has his bike. Still hobbling. Now remember, this kid was in a wheelchair for like 3 months because he had a fixator on the outside of his hip to hold him together. Comes back, first race, second place after slipping back to 10th in the beginning, cuts his way back up to get a second place. And that might have been one of the best races I've ever seen from anybody because he had to overcome his fear at the track that he got hit and ran over. He was able to get back right on the horns, even though he wasn't 100%, put all his faith into the bike, and brought it home second. It was one of the most emotional feelings we've had as a team, as I've had personally in the racing series that I've worked in. And it was a tragic moment that turned into a glorious moment at the very end. So it was a very cool thing to see that he could overcome that. And he had a few more seasons of racing in him. And now he's off being a hippie and a rock climber now. So he's having a good old time with life. But that was a pretty cool experience during my racing time as a mechanic.
That's a wild story. I'll give you that one. So, I guess it's my turn. So, as you all know, I did do club racing. And, you know, I'm not going to make this about me, but he was talking successes and crashes. So, I'll give you the success, then I'll tell you the crash story. So, it's 1989, and we were a pro-am at the time. So I just basically had gotten my pro license, but you were still allowed to run amateur races. And so they were going to have a 250 Pro-Am National Championship at Henry, Illinois. So the amateur nationals were going to be held in Illinois that year. All right, well, we're going to go do the half mile. So we get up like 1 a.m. We drive like the 7 hours to get there. It's like any other typical dirt track in the Midwest. It's at some fairgrounds and you show up and everybody else kind of trickles in. And so We get there and we go out. We look at the track and we walk around a little bit. Dad and I look at it. Typical pea gravel, half mile. And it seemed like the turns were a little tight and the straight was kind of a little bit long. So we just kind of look at each other and we was like, yep, all right, let's put a 1447 on it as far as gearing. You know, 14 on tooth counter shaft and a 47 rear sprocket. And we'll go at it. Now, the bike that I had then was a 1980 Honda 250, but it was a factory flat track motor. It had a right hand shift in it that came from Honda themselves. Like, you could buy this as a little crate motor, and it had a different cylinder, different porting, because it's two stroke and it had this right hand shift. And that bike was just awesome. Me and that bike just chilled, and I probably won more races on that bike than I did at any other time. So we go out, we're there at the nationals, and we run around, and we had our heat. We look good. We won the heat. All right. And then, you know, Dad looks over and is like, wait a minute. The carburetor on the bike's leaking. It's like, what do you mean? I'm kind of looking at it. So the plug that goes in the bottom of the float bowl, we'd either torqued the gasket or kind of had stripped the threads or whatever. So we're kind of running around the pits trying to find someone who would like loan us a gasket or a float bowl or something for the carburetor on the bike. Of course, nobody would, because this is the nationals and everybody got their butt pretty much handed to them by us at the beginning of that time. So Dad's like, well, we got one shot at this. So he kind of took some silicone, cleaned it all up, siliconed it back together again. We go out there and we win the nationals. We won a national championship. So I have that number one plate. It hangs in my garage. And that was probably one of the coolest things that we ever did. Because it was just me and my mom and my dad. That's how we went racing. And we were all there and we did something that we always had wanted to do. No one was going to take away that at that day we were the fastest guys on a half mile with a 250 motorcycle. So that's the most successful thing I probably ever did. And it's one of those things that I will remember forever. So that was really cool. In fact, it was so cool. My mom made it our Christmas card that year. It was a picture of me and the checkered flag on my bike.
Nice. Dude, I love stories like that. There's always, you know, I think all of us here do love racing, but personal achievements all hold a special little place in our heart. And we tend to, you know, love to get on those stories, have a few beers and talk that. And once a racer, always a racer, I say, no matter what level. But Steve did bring up an interesting thing when he did ask the point, imagine would it be different with the MotoGP guys? Yeah, I imagine it'd be quite different. And the fact that the scale would be massively different than anything that I ever dealt with in my days as a wrench. If I was a mechanic for a MotoGP team, I can't imagine the resources, the availability, the travel. I mean, it's the apples to oranges is never, it wouldn't even be close. AFM racing that I did and some AMA stuff that I did would fail in comparison to what anything MotoGP would have to offer, even as a mechanic for one of those teams.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the difference is literally commitment, dedication, talent, and money. I mean, I think everyone's got that dedication, but when you have to have a job to do your hobby. And these guys that go to the top generally don't have that. Cause I mean, you could, and it's another good story, but you know, we were road racing at the time. I'd finally started road racing and we were at Putnam Park in Indiana, and who shows up but Roger Lee Hayden. And what bike does he have? Tommy's old ZX6 for the 600 class. So, you know, he's got like I think at the time, Tommy was actually riding for Muzzy. So you knew that bike was fast. And, you know, everybody else kind of shows up and you've worked all week. You've worked on your own bike. You show up and, you know, here comes Roger Lee. Arguably was a bike that none of us were going to have anything remotely close to. And he, you know, had everything that they needed. You know, there was no lack of needing new tires or anything. Plus, they were dedicated to that craft, right? I mean, that's all that any of the Haydens ever did. They raced motorcycles. That's what they did. They didn't really do anything else. And that's a big difference. It's a huge difference in what you're doing and what you're not doing. So, yeah, that's the difference there. So. But, you know, Steve did ask about crashes, so I got to tell the crash story, if I may.
Oh, for sure. So I've got nowhere else to be. Let's knock it out.
This one's a little bit long. I warn you, it is a little bit gory, but we will endeavor to go down this.
Oh, I've got mine too, so lead the way.
Okay. All right. So I think this might have been like 1997. We were in Blackhawk Farms Raceway, which is in South Beloit, Illinois. It's right on the border between Illinois and Wisconsin. And it's kind of a little track, and it's kind of there. And the main thing is that everybody, all the rich boys and girls in Chicago, take their really nice cars, their BMWs, their Audis, their Porsches, and they go to Blackhawk Farms and they run their cars around there. So it's kind of more of a track day kind of a place. As opposed to, and it's not that it isn't a real racetrack, but trying to give you an idea of the flair of what's there. So we go there, and I think there's like 9 turns on the track. So like I go through the 7th turn, which is we're out in practice, early September morning. We're out practicing. And my dad would always be in the pits. So you had like, you know, 10 or 15 minutes of practice time. And we would come in and we'd make adjustments to the suspension stuff. So my dad always had the screwdrivers or whatever tools he needed to adjust suspension on the bike. So I did a few laps. Bike, the front end wasn't very good. So I whipped into the pits. My dad made an adjustment to the rebound on the forks. And I go back out again. Man, this thing's feeling great. So I go whizzing through turn 7, which was a right-hander that led onto like a kinked straightaway. And the kink was turn 8, and then there was a 90 degree turn, right turn to go back up the main straightaway. Well, that little kink, there was a seam in the pavement where all the cars would kind of hook a tire in that seam. And if you hit that seam just right, you could use it sort of like a berm with the bike. I'm like, man, I'm just going to, you know, I sucked it up. I got all the courage. I'm all 24 years old, and, you know, I can't die, right? I don't know what death or fear it is, because I am invincible, yes. So I go rattling through there, probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 110. I hit that, and I don't know what happened, but I hit it wrong. Next thing I know, the handlebars are ripped out of my hands, and I'm going along the straightaway at 110 miles an hour, sit upright like somebody on a 10-speed bicycle. I look like Lance Armstrong after winning the Tour de France, you know? Arms up. So I'm like, I realize I have two choices at this point. I either got to somehow figure out how to fight the wind and pull myself back onto the front of this motorcycle, slam the brakes on and try to stop it or slow it down to make the turn, or it's time to get off the motorcycle. Well, I made the decision of, well, let's get off the motorcycle. So I jump off, I hit the ground, and I'm sliding across the pavement. And of course, this is early in the morning and it's September, so the grass is all dewy. Now they've cut the grass, they've mowed the grass like you would mow your lawn, probably like maybe 10 or 15 feet out of the racetrack bounds. And then after that, it was tall, high grass that was just grown up. So I'm sliding across the asphalt, and shit is starting to get hot inside the leathers, right? Because I'm going across, and so I'm starting to feel heat. The next thing I feel is like I feel cooling because I've hit the grass. But the problem is now I don't have any friction because there's dew on the grass. So I start speeding up. So now my body is accelerating as I'm sliding across the entire grassy area. Okay, I figure at some point I'm going to stop here. So what happens is I hit the tall grass and I get lifted up like a ramp. I probably fly up maybe only 2 feet off the ground. And then I'm there motionless, floating in air, going like, you've got to be kidding me. When is this ride going to end? And I go, whomp, and I smack onto the ground. I'm like, whoa, that hurt. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, take inventory of things. Can I see? Yeah. I know where I am. Did my fingers work? Yep. Did my toes wiggle? Yep. All right, cool. Let's try to stand up. I stand up. Everything's cool. I'm like looking for my bike. I don't know where it went. All of a sudden, here comes the corner workers that are rushing up like, dude, you okay? Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm fine. Where's my bike? Dude, it must be in Illinois. It must be all the way to Wisconsin by now. Oh, so the bike just went straight. Just, you know, gyroscopes in the wheels, gyroscopic wheels, right? Just kept on going straight. So we go back, and there's all these little like sapling trees that are all knocked down and beat down because the bike had gone through this little sapling area. So we look like a bunch of people running through the woods trying to get away from an axe murderer or something. We finally find the bike. It's like, okay. So we pick it up, and first thing I think of is there's going to be like some sort of like a branch or a tree through the radiator or something like that.
Yeah.
No, it looks pretty good, man. The only thing that's broke is the windscreen or whatever is broke on it or whatever. I'm like, well, okay, we get it upright. Let's fire this thing up. Sure enough, we fire it up. Everything's good. Ride back up through the weeds, go across the track, go through the pits. My dad's there. He looks at me. I was like, yeah, just point at the windscreen. He's like, okay. And I ride back through the pits to where I am. So I get back there. I stop. My dad shows up on the pit bike. We get the bike on the stand. And I go to take off my helmet. And my dad's starting to get everything out of the trailer to fix the bike. And I go, and I'm trying to pick up my left hand. Well, my left arm, I can't really like pick it up to take my helmet off. I'm like, hey, mom, give me a hand, get this helmet off. And she's like, okay. So we get my helmet off, you know, and I got that off. And I still really can't I can like grip my hand and stuff, but I can't really move it right. I'm like, let's get my leathers off. So my mom's pulling my leathers off, you know, and we're bouncing around. And all of a sudden my mom goes, ugh! I'm like, what? Now, you know, my mom is tough as nails. We've been dirt trekking every which way. And seeing me crash, do everything, never has my mom ever made a sound at any cut, bruise, break, anything I had. So I'm like, this must be really pretty wild. So I use my right hand to pick up my left elbow, and I pick up and I bend my arm back to where like my hand's touching my shoulder. And I can look through the muscle there at the elbow, and I can see stuff moving when I move my fingers. It looked like somebody had taken a meat grinder or a belt sander and had just ground down all the meat off of my elbow.
Oh, jeez.
So I'm there, and I'm like, all of a sudden, I was like, my dad comes out, and he looks, and he's like, because he hears the noise. So my dad pops back out of the trailer, and my dad looks at it, and he's like, yeah, I think we need to go see the paramedics. Now, at Black Hawk Farms, there's an actual tower building where, like, you signed up and where the announcing was done, and the EMTs sat there with the ambulance. So I start walking down with my leathers half hanging down like road racers do. And there was a guy who ran around in this old Buick who was a security guard. He looks at me and he says, where are you going? I was like, I'm going to the EMTs because I'm holding my arm up. He goes, hop in, I'll take you down. It's like, okay, thanks. So he drops me off at the door. I open the door up and there's the EMTs. And they're like, why are you here? So I hold my arm up. They're like, oh, sit down. You sit down right now. Okay, cool. So I sit down and all of a sudden I'm sitting there and all of a sudden the guy says, hey, you need to lay down. I'm like, why? He says, well, you're about to go into, you're in shock. I'm like, really? This is what shock feels like? He goes, yeah, lay down now. We need to get some oxygen on you. Oh, okay, fine. So I lay down. He puts oxygen on me. And I'm probably laying there flat for maybe 30 seconds. And all of a sudden I go, yo, buddy. He's like, what? I said, I'm going to throw up. He says, what do you mean you're going to throw up? I said, I am going to barf, okay? I need to barf. So he pulls the mask off. He gets me one of those little cups. And I retch my guts into this cup, right? In this little banana. And the EMT looks at it and he goes, oh, God, what is that? And I go, blue Gatorade, a brownie, and a banana. He's like, God, he walks off. So long story short, they wind up, you know, getting me back to where I can be coherent again and I'm not in shock and all that good stuff. They said, yeah, you're going to have to probably go get stitches and all this. I said, yeah, probably. So consequently, I go and I head back and I'm walking back, mom and dad. I got directions to the hospital and dad's got everything packed up with mom. And we get in the van and we start heading to the hospital. So we get to the little hospital there. And of course, we walk in and, you know, hey, came from the racetrack. Oh, yeah, they called. They said you'd be coming. I said, yeah, okay. So I go in the room and, of course, there's this decision about what they want to do. Do they want to put some stitches in me or, you know, what exactly are they going to do? And finally, the head doctor there, he comes in and he decides, well, we're going to let this heal by secondary intervention. We'll just clean it up. We'll bandage it and everything will just go fine. Just check up with your local doctor. Okay, sure, no problem. So they've got to clean this wound. So, of course, what walks in, but of course, this very cute nurse. She's going to take care of this wound. She says, oh, here you're at the racetrack and you fell down and hurt yourself. Yep, sure did. She goes, you know what? Why don't you lay down on your stomach? So she lays on my stomach, so my arm's up backwards. And she says, let me shoot that up with Novocaine for you. Nah, I go, nah, I don't need no Novocaine, man. You know, because I'm thinking I got a chance at this, man. Because, you know, here's Mr. Macho Race Guy. He's not going to take any Novocaine for this. So she looks at me and I swear to God, she took this like scrub brush out and she says, and put it in front of my face. She says, are you sure you don't want the Novocaine for that? I'm like, nah, I got this. She says, okay. Oh my God, dude, I went through the roof. I screamed like a little girl when she hit me with that brush, and then she had to shoot it up with Novocaine.
I know that all too
finally,
well.
Finally, she wound up, so she scraped. She'd been around the block a few times with that one. And anyway, so from there on, and this is no joke, for about two or three years after that, my wound would fester, and it would spit out a piece of gravel. So I used to joke I took a bit of the track with me wherever I went.
Nice.
So that's a long story, but that is probably the worst accident I ever had.
So
was that one.
For me, it's I have some comparisons with your story with mine, and you'll see that as I go to tell it. But obviously, I did have a crash on a track, but it was relatively safe. I high-sided fast time, bounced around in my leathers. I got up, had some bruising, which is why it's important to wear your leathers, because my worst crash came. It was a slow-speed crash, but I was at work one day. And my boss handed me my paycheck, and I was like, you know what? I'm going to run down to the bank at lunch and cash this out, so I'm ready to go for the weekend. I don't have to worry about it, because going to the bank on a Friday at 5 o'clock is terrible. At the time, this was before direct deposit for any job that I had. I needed to stand in line. So I grabbed, you know, I just hopped on. It was my shorts and my T-shirt. I threw on a hoodie and grabbed my helmet and gloves and took off to the bank. It's only 2 miles away. What's the worst that can happen, right, Jim? Well,
yeah,
things can go bad quickly. So what happened is I'm going down the streets about 40 miles an hour and I'm following this lady. She's in her car and she's not relatively close, but I'm within, I don't know, maybe 3-4 seconds behind her. And so she pulls over to like to a curb. And so I'm thinking she's going to pull into this little driveway, but she doesn't. She actually pulls up to the driveway and opens the car door. So I'm going, oh shit. I wasn't really expecting to slow down. I don't really have time to, you know, hit the brakes now. So what I did instead is I looked to my left. I see a gap between two cars. I kind of shoot the motorcycle over. I missed the door by about a foot. And I was like, woo, that was a close one. But then at the same time, I'm on the ass of this blue Expedition. And I know it was a blue Expedition. So I remember vividly looking at the actual stamp there on the back saying, like, Expedition, it's blue. And I said, I can't really sit behind this Expedition. And I was like, oh, man, this is going to be way too close. I need to dip out from behind this car. And so I yanked the handlebar, shoot myself over to the right, only to realize the cars in that lane had come to a complete stop. And I was like, oh shit, this is not going to be good. So I grabbed the front brake and I got on the front wheel. I start to endo and my feet come off the pegs and the back of the motorcycle hits the back of my helmet. That's how vertical I had gotten. And I was on the brake. And when that happened, I went off the eject, hit the eject button, went over the front of the handlebars and went tumbling down the road at about 30 so miles an hour, rolling around, bouncing around. The bike missed me by a few feet and I went sliding around on the ground in my shorts and everything. And so I popped right up from the ground, got up, I picked the bike up, kind of put it on the curb because adrenaline is coursing through me. I look back, the car that I almost hit is gone. The lady that opened the car door there that was there, she's gone. The car that was next to me is gone. I said, well, hell, I guess there's really nobody to report to. I should probably just get back on the bike and get back to work because if I sit around too much longer, this shock is going to wear off and I'm going to be in a bunch of pain. So I go to pull like my pants up because they feel like they're loose and I keep pulling them up and they keep falling down. I'm like, what is going on? Well, what happened was they ripped open completely except at the top. So I'm kind of standing there in my boxers and coming out of stores. They're all looking. They're like, what? I'm like, why are you guys staring at me? And the lady's like, are you okay? I'm like, I'm fine. I'm fine. I'm okay. She goes, are you sure? I'm like, I'm fine. She goes, have you looked at yourself? And I look down and my entire right leg is covered in blood. I can see the top of my kneecap, which is not good. The entire right side, I've got gravel. I look down, my sweater has fused into my skin on my right arm and into my back. And so I was like, well, this is not good. And so I was like, well, I ripped the mirrors off the bike. I kicked a couple pieces of plastic that were broken. And I said, and I asked the lady, hey, can you do me a favor and throw these away? She said, yeah. I'm like, cool. I start the bike, hop on, and take off. And so, mind you, I was about 22 at the time. So I still had this kind of strength. Work was still about a mile and a half away. With about a quarter of a mile to go, the shock was wearing off. I was sitting at a light. The guy next to me looks over, rolls down the window and goes, hey, bud, are you okay? And I was like, I'm not okay, but I'm trying to get to a place where I can just park this motorcycle. He goes, you should call an ambulance. I'm like, I know. And I pull away from the light. And tears are just coming down my face. Like, the wind is whipping on all of these open sores that are bleeding profuse. I'm pretty sure the cars behind me are getting blood wicked up onto the windshield. It's probably pretty gross. I finally get to work. I park the bike. I stumble into the warehouse and kind of fall onto the ground. And my coworker walks over and goes, hey, man, what are you doing? Oh, shit. And I was like, yeah, can you find some pants? Lucky for me, I worked at an apparel motorcycle apparel shop. And we had some, like, Alpine Star sweats or something. So my boss comes around, grabs the first aid kit. They bandaged me up the best they could. Throw on the sweats. I call my dad. I'm like, hey, dad, don't tell mom, but I crashed the motorcycle again. And I need you to come pick me up. I got to go to the doctor. I got to go to the ER. He's like, okay, cool. So my dad rolls up, and he betrayed me. Here's my mom in the car with a panicked look. She's like, oh, my God, are you okay? And they load me into the back. You know who's sitting in the back of the car? There's my grandma. And I'm like, oh, Jesus Christ. Like, I've got to sit there and explain this to everybody. And my grandma is definitely someone who's super worried. She liked motorcycles, but she definitely didn't like me riding them. Neither did my mom. Dad didn't care. But here I am, you know, all beat up. I can't bend my leg anymore because now my knee is probably the size of three softballs now. Just, it's all swollen up, you know, it's still pouring blood out of the top where I can see my kneecap. Like, I can see like veins and muscle tissue and everything else. Like, oh shit, this is not good. And so I go to the ER and they're like, you know, I come around the back and the nurse is like, you know, this Filipino nurse is like, whoa, you stupid man. And I was like, yeah, I didn't have all the gear on. She's like, lay down. She says, I'll be right back. She comes back with three other nurses and a tray with all these metal brushes on it. And I was like, oh, I wonder what this is for. She goes, okay. She starts telling me. Yeah, she goes, go over here. Go over. She's telling these nurses, go over. So one grabs my leg. The other comes by, pins me down on my shoulders. And she goes, lay back, lay back. And the other one kind of like grabs my arms and kind of like, they kind of like basically lock me into a position a jiu-jitsu master would be proud of, right? She goes, okay, prepare for this to hurt. I'm like, do I not get any painkillers? She goes, no, you are stupid. Here you go. And I was like, what? And she just starts scraping all of the rocks out of my leg with these metal brushes, and they're pouring like iodine on me and everything else. And I was like, ooh, ooh. And finally, like enough like time, like it must have been, it probably was only 10 seconds, but it felt like an eternity to me. My body kind of went back into shock, and I couldn't really feel it anymore. It just kind of felt, I felt the metal brushes, but the pain had subsided at that point. Until they hit kind of like maybe some closer to some nerves and kind of got me moving around. But then they plastered me with all of this like anti, what is the like disinfectant cream, and it was all of that stuff, Neosporin and whatever. And they wrapped me back up and they said, okay, since you can't take these bandages off for 2 days, you got to let the stuff sit in and heal. But on the second day, you probably want to take a bath and then take these bandages off. And I was like, okay, cool. Thanks. Bye. So I go home and I am, the next day I wake up and, you know, everything hurts, but at least I have some nice, fun painkillers. But these bandages stink. And I'm like, ah, you know what? I'm going to take a shower and rip these bandages off and be good to go. Well, there's a specific reason they tell you to take a bath. It's to let the bandages soak so they become very soft when you take them off. They don't rip your skin. Well, I'm an idiot because I was like, oh, shower is the same thing, right? Wrong. Very wrong. I went ahead and like cut the side of the bandages and gave him a rip. Well, I took all of that brand new skin with it too and basically reopened every single wound that I had, and all the good work that they had done patching me up. I just opened it back up and then bled in the shower and started crying again. had to get out of the shower. I ruined two towels and had to have my mom come in and like dress everything back up and have my dad like help me up off the floor and get me back to my bed until the painkillers kicked in. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is why you wear all of your gear all of the time.
That public service announcement brought to you by, what was that IPA you were drinking?
It's going to be Snarf Snarf.
This PSA brought to you by Snarf Snarf.
There you go.
Wear your gear.
All right. So now we've kind of got through that. Let's keep it rolling because we're already at an hour, so we'll kind of blast through the last little bit here. One of the things Steve did ask the question, he goes, I'm a little bit curious about how much a team can change the competitiveness of the machine on a weekend. We know the superstars tend to continue being superstars most of the time, but I'm wondering how much a smart, hardworking team can affect the outcome. In the most simplest terms, it's massive. Even at my AFM level, we could probably get, we would show up there with the base setting and we would start working on that bike. And a lot of times we could squeeze out a second to a second and a half on a track from getting the rider comfortable to finding the optimal setup. It's a massive change over a weekend.
Yeah. If you want a more MotoGP centric equation, I give you Tech 3 and LCR, because Tech 3, when we moved off Bridgestone and went to Michelin, all they did with Hervé Poncharel and Zarco was they just focused on their bike, their setup, and making Zarco comfortable, and Zarco went fast. So same thing, LCR, you had Crutchlow won in Australia with that bike. He won in a couple other places with that bike. And again, he's doing it because he can ride well. He's doing it because he's got the bike set up for him. They've made smart decisions. And yeah, a couple of those times, you know, when Crutchlow won in Brno, that was the right call on tires at the right time. So all of those things mean something to you, because you have to remember one thing about racing. Luck is when preparation meets opportunity, and that's what those teams were looking for. And LCR has done it several times. So, there you go.
Yeah, it definitely can make a big difference. He also wants to know, he wants to hear some comparisons between a MotoGP bike and the kind of awesome, yet not even close to MotoGP level awesome that you can buy at your local bike shop. I mean, even if my riding skills are ridiculously low, I still imagine being on the bikes that when I watch a race, they're supposed to be prototypes. So exactly what are all the prototype parts or whatever that makes them that way? Easy, simple answer. Everything is prototype on those machines. Handmade, one-off. There's probably six versions of that part. They're made of unobtainium, carbon fiber, you name it, stuff that will make it down, trickle down to street bikes. It usually probably takes about at least 5 or 6 years before you're seeing some of that stuff. It's maybe a little faster these days, but it's a big, big jump. You're going to see closer from the World Superbike to the stuff you can buy. But even then, a World Superbike bike, I think the last time I heard a figure was when Ben Spies wrecked his bike. So Yamaha, if you went and bought the R1 at that time, it's going to set you back about 13,000-14,000. The bike he was riding was 400,000. So there you go. Big jump between what you buy on the street, which is still these days a very visceral machine, to a complete prototype. Prototypes have stuff you've never seen, stuff that we'll never will see because it doesn't make it out of racing. And some crazy engineering goes into prototype racing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of the prototype bikes have all sorts of sand castings because they're making one-off or very few parts. The electronics are things that you're never going to get. Yes, the electronics on your street bike today are really pretty good, but they're not as good as what the teams have. The suspension, the Ohlins guys have all kinds of trick parts. They're titanium nitride coated and silicone infused tubes that make them slide so that the nasty stiction isn't there. Mark Miller always talked about this, the monoblock calipers that Brembo makes that are on the bikes. They're more rigid because they're machined from one piece of aluminum. Therefore, they have better bite and better feel back to the rider. You're not going to get those. You know, there's all custom foot pegs, hand pegs, Wow. I think like I'm drinking the IPA. but custom made hand controls, all that kind of stuff so that, you know, you are 100% comfortable on that motorcycle. I mean, they're all... It's all custom. Look at Lorenzo. They were building him little wings from HRC that were rapid prototype parts that were basically printed out of plastic that they glued onto the gas tank to give him the ability to have leverage with his knees to hold onto it while he was trying to brake. You know, carbon fiber brakes, you're not going to get those on your street bike. Never going to happen because you can't really, you can't generate enough heat with them to make them work on the street. The other thing too is that all those exhaust systems are made from like probably like 22 gauge titanium. For that, you know, titanium has advantages in heat distribution and helps it to cool and charge. And you could never, as an average street rider, average track day rider, even club racer, unless you're really, really pushing it, you're not going to be able to get any advantage from having a titanium exhaust like these guys have and can get and can do. So those are a few things that I wrote down for the stuff that makes your MotoGP bike different than your bike you can buy from the dealer.
Absolutely. Alrighty. So kind of getting close to the end of his email. Another thing that he was curious about is some things that make a particular corner great from a track or from a rider's viewpoint. For me, because Jim's probably going to be able to have some better insight on this, but to me, what makes a corner great sometimes isn't necessarily the corner, but the what precedes it. And it gives you a nice flow or a passing opportunity. So what comes to mind to me is at Assen, and you get the final chicane. Well, it isn't just the chicane, it's the like three corners before that. They get this nice flow. They give you optional lines that create a lot of passing opportunities and different ways to take those corners, but it also makes for exciting racing. And that is definitely something that, as a spectator, I look for. And as somebody that's done a few track days, I think my favorite corners would be the ones that are always with a nice clear view on the exit so you know exactly where you're going. Decreasing radius sucks to me, but a wide open, like full pin throttle as you're rolling the back, you know, tire under the fat part is good stuff.
Yeah, for me, I think what makes it good is I like to have a track where I can find a rhythm, where I can get into the rhythm with the bike. Putnam Park was always that way for me. I always could just find the rhythm and just click off laps at that track. I like tracks that give you the feel like you're going someplace. Road America was that way. You know, Road America, you feel like you're going somewhere. You leave, you go out into the woods, you go up and downhill a little bit, and suddenly you come back again, and you're like, wow, hey, I'm here. Elevation plays a big part as to whether a track is good or not, in my opinion. Coda has elevation changes to it. Mugello, elevation changes to it. Those tracks, we really tend to like. Sachsenring, elevation change. So even though it's all on the left side of the tire for a long part of the race, you're going up and downhill. I think that makes it all there. What makes a particular corner great for me is I like things where the ace, where you have to have all the apexes that have to be strung together to make it go perfectly. Sort of like Coda, the S's, you have to string every apex together properly to be fast through there. Those are really super cool. I always liked the really super fast corners. When I was racing, we would go to Elkhart Lake, and they did not have the chicane on the run down to Canada Corner. So you came out of the carousel having been on the right side of the tire as you fell down the hill. Incredibly challenging corner because you kept going faster and faster and faster as you went through it. And then you got to the kink, and there was nothing more fun than going through that kink at 120 miles an hour. The front end is already hot and slimy because of the carousel. You dip it into the right, you're fifth gear, you're on your knee, and the front end is just gooey and it just wants to fold under, and you just push with your knee to put it back on center, and you fly through it. And as soon as it grabs and catches on that center mass of the tire, you flick it back left to get to the other direction. And you know, that is just that edge that, you know, for me, it's that edge. You got to be on a corner where, like, you are so at the limit. Like, this is just razor thin. I am a millimeter away from crashing, and you come through with that rush, that just adrenaline rush you can't get from doing anything else. I mean, I guess maybe skydiving or something like that is close, but I've never done that. So that's what works for me for tracks and corners and things that make them great.
Nice. All right, so we get to the end of C's email. He goes, anyways, that's a lot of thoughts. So I'm a longtime listener. And goes, he thinks he's been listening it since at least Casey Stoner was racing at Laguna Seca. So it's got to be some years. Yeah, if you were all the way back, I mean, Casey started racing at Laguna Seca all the way back to 2006. So if you've been joining us since then, you're a decade plus with us, which means you probably started listening to around episode, 150, 200. So you have been with us for quite some time. Steve, we do appreciate that and continue listening. And thank you for writing in. This provided a lot of great topics for the show. And for anybody else, go ahead and write in. Obviously, we love doing this. Breaking down and gives me and Jim an opportunity to kind of think of things we don't normally get to talk about on this show. And we're going to go ahead and keep trying to pump these out until racing starts. But thanks again, Steve. We do appreciate it. And that kind of brings us to the end of the show. Jim, did you want to cover anything before we take off?
No, I'm good with everything. I really appreciate the thought that you put into the email, Steve. There's a lot of great things in there. I hope you enjoyed all the answers to everything that you asked. I hope you keep listening. And thank you very much.
All right, folks, let's go ahead and close this out. We're over our usual hour, but we didn't ramble on nearly as much as last time, which is going to make editing for this a little bit easier. All right, folks, don't forget, you can email us at motopod@motopodcast.com. Just like Steve did, just like Joshua did, just like Al Fleming did. Go ahead, write us in. We're going to get to you. Give us plenty of topics to talk about. And like I said, go ahead and give me some beer recommendations. I'm always willing to try something out and let you know how I feel about it. You can also reach us at facebook.com/motopod. That's our Motopod fan page. Go on there, give us a like. Interact with other motopodders on there as well, not just the hosts. Have a good chat, some banter about motorbikes. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at moto_pod. You can follow us there for any news, announcements, and greater motorcycle banter. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at SkylarV28. Jim, where can people find you?
Instagram, Twitter, at MotoRGV. Got some foodie stuff on Instagram here lately, but we've been cooking and making, so check it out.
Right on. All right, folks, well, that's it for this show. Thank you so much for tuning in. Jim, it was a pleasure as always. Until next time, everyone.
Love the stories, man.
Take it easy.